13-20-101-CR and 13-20-102-CR, the State of Texas versus Sebastian Torres.
May I please the court, opposing counsel? Good morning, Chief Justice Contreras, Justice Hinojosa, Justice Silva. We're here today on what seems to be an issue of first impression. This case arises out of a capital murder that occurred in Starr County, Texas in 2017. Mr. Torres, the appellee in this case, was 16 years old at the time. He was considered a juvenile. And he was amongst four of the individuals that was arrested for the murder and disposition of the body of 17-year-old Chase Olivares. After being certified as an adult in 2017, Mr. Torres was indicted by a grand jury in Starr County on three charges: capital murder, tampering with physical evidence, and tampering with a human corpse. In 2019, the trial court heard a first motion to suppress. That was before Judge Robert Garza. He denied the motion to suppress and found that the appellee, Mr. Torres, voluntarily, knowingly, and intelligently waived his rights. 2 weeks later, the Fifth Administrative Region appointed a new judge, Judge Robert Valdez, to preside over the case, over this case and the case of two other defendants or co-defendants. The appellee asked Judge Valdez to make findings of facts and conclusions of law based on the first motion to suppress, and Judge Valdez said he could not since he was not the presiding judge. So the parties agreed to have a second motion to suppress. That happened in November of 2019. Judge Valdez held that hearing. Both parties presented their evidence. And after they presented their evidence, Judge Valdez asked the parties to submit briefs to support their arguments. Now, at that hearing, the appellee, or Mr. Torres, argued that the state did not comply with Section 51.09F of the Texas Family Code. Now, that specific section of the Family Code has to do with statements of juveniles. And there's five specific ways that a statement of a juvenile can, that they can be made. And Section 51.095 tells us, and I cited this in my brief in Henry Mack, one, by a written statement; two, an oral statement evidencing the child's guilt; three, a registered statement; four, statements made in court proceedings; and five, a recorded statement. Now, in Henry Mack, each one was viewed independently. Mr. Torres made a recorded statement. So, in the hearing, defense counsel or appellee argued that the follow-up procedures were not followed up by the state, specifically subsection F, that the magistrate did not go back and view the statement with the child and determine that it was voluntary, and that he had to do that because he invoked it in the recording when he gave the warnings to Mr. Torres, and that is correct. When Mr. Torres went to the Starr County Sheriff's Office, he was given his warnings once, and he decided not to speak to law enforcement. He was then arrested and taken to the juvenile detention center. Then sometime later during that evening, late at night, he was then again taken to Justice of the Peace Barrera because he wanted to speak to law enforcement. He was given his warnings once again, and he decided to waive them. Now, in that form, which is part of the record, there is a box, and it says optional directive. Justice Barrera checked it off, and it says, "I'm asking that the child be brought back to me to view the statement and determine whether the statement was given voluntarily." He spoke it onto the recording as well, and it's also part of the record. Mr. Torres goes off with law enforcement. He gives a 2.5-hour confession. He even takes them out to the crime scene and tells them where Mr. Olivares' body could possibly be found, and they find the body the next day. Now, he is never brought back to Justice Barrera. They come back at around 4 in the morning. He's never brought back. Justice Barrera never makes that determination whether it was voluntary or not. He never makes it in writing. He never views the statement. So they argued, because subsection F was not followed and he invoked it in the recording, and the family code has to be strictly complied with, the statement has to be thrown out. And in February,
the findings that were made by the trial court, strictly on that provision.
Correct. In February of 2020, Judge Valdez granted it basically on that provision, saying that since the state did not comply with that and that no exception applied, because that as soon as the language in subsection F was invoked by the justice of the peace, that was dominant and no exception applied. Now, the state in its brief argues that the trial court erred because if you read the language of subsection F, it is completely discretionary. Yes, he invoked it, but he never viewed the statement.
But if it's his discretion, the discretion lies within his ability to invoke it, does it not?
Correct.
Otherwise, if we go along with your argument, anytime it's invoked, as it was in this case, and if it doesn't matter until, you know, if he's not given the opportunity to view it, then there will be disregard for it all the time.
I'm not saying that it doesn't matter. I think it matters. I don't think it was the legislative intent. I don't think it was the legislature's intent to have that subsection and twist it in a way to make it a technicality and throw out a good confession where due process was not violated, where there was no police coercion.
Well, but counselor, why have that statute anyway? I mean, my understanding is the purpose of the statute is that when you are dealing with a juvenile, that there has to be sort of another layer of protection of the child's rights. And I could see your argument, because I know you do you make the argument of the may is used throughout the language of the provision. But yet, wouldn't you agree that once the magistrate says that, you know, and says, yes, I want to have the child brought back, you know, that then the discretion is upon the magistrate based on the circumstances, whether he's even going to require that. In this case, he did it, and then it didn't become up. It wasn't up to the officers to disregard the order, I guess, at that point of the magistrate. Now, the magistrate could have, once a child gets presented back, then again, it's the other two provisions are also optional on the magistrate because it also says may and may. Mm-hmm. But once there's an order by the magistrate and it's disregarded by the officers, then at that point, isn't it clearly a violation of the provision in the statute or the requirements of the statute?
I don't believe that it was violated at that point. I believe that there would have been a violation if he would have viewed it and he wouldn't have made his findings in writing.
And what is your basis for that belief?
I don't have any case law. There is no case law out there that I could find that goes hand in hand with this. However, the appellee in their brief, they cite Rocamora v. State, right? And that has to do with a totally different section, but it has to do with strict compliance because they say strictly complied with. They talk about, you know, juveniles, extra layer of protection, right? Just like you said, Justice Hinojosa. And that's a court of a criminal appeals case. And they're talking about taking the juvenile to a processing facility and that, you know, juveniles have to be extra protected. But I asked the court to read the concurring opinions in that case of Justice Womack and Justice Holcomb. And Justice Womack says there are exceptions to the requirements of laws, even the ones that are very important and must be obeyed strictly. Here, the harm in 5202 of the Texas Family Code that seeks to protect is clearly not outweighed by the exigency that it occurred in this case. I agree that the statute must be enforced here. I write only to point out that the statute may not prevail against every other need in society in all cases. Then Justice Holcomb goes on to say, the majority states we have clearly established a policy of strict compliance with the Family Code and states further, we will continue to require strict compliance. I'm uncertain why these statements were included or what they really mean. Neither of these cases relied on by the majority relied on strict compliance. In Baptist, we remind police of the family code's strict requirements. However, we certainly did not mean to imply that some laws should be enforced more strictly than others. All laws enacted by the legislature are of equal dignity and deserve equal enforcement. Hence, it is clearly wrong to suggest that this court can choose which laws require more or less compliance. And that goes into my second argument, that the trial court completely disregarded subsection A2, the found to be true exception.
But was there any evidence put on to support of any findings under A2?
Mr. Torres's confession, Judge, if the court views it, you can hear in the recording where the investigator is asking Mr. Torres, we need to find the body. Help us. And he says, okay, well, I'll take you to the lagoon. I ask you to view that confession. Yes, it's 2 hours, but the decision that you make with this case will have a huge impact.
What about the requirement that the fact that he was in custody? And there's this case law has been cited that said that A2 doesn't apply mm-hmm. when the juvenile is in custody. Well, you've cited a N. Ray J.B. where mm-hmm. they did admit the statement under A2, even though the child was in custody, but it's an unpublished opinion and has not been cited by anybody.
Right. Well, in SDJ, and I cited that in my brief as well, in that one, the juvenile gave an oral statement. They argued that it was inadmissible because he was in custody at the time when the statement was given, and a juvenile chief probation officer gave him the warnings instead of a magistrate. He then, after the probation officer gave him the warnings, he voluntarily talked to law enforcement. He gave incriminating statements. And then was taken to a JP, and then he invoked his right to counsel, but the court held the oral confession referred to evidence that corroborated the confession. He gave the exact location of items that had been hidden and were used in the murder, and that was affirmed. So I asked
the
court to look.
That
was SDJ v. State, and it's cited in my brief, Judge.
But the findings of facts and conclusions of law that were entered in this case have nothing to do with that other provision. There were absolutely no findings made at all.
No.
With regard to A2.
Correct. At the last hearing that we had on the record, I asked the Judge Valdez to make those findings. And on the record, he does say that... he found my argument not persuasive, and that 51.09F was dominant, and that the exception did not apply.
But the appellee is arguing that you did not present any evidence at the hearing of what led to the, you know, what it was that was determined based on the confession. But you're saying that we should read the confession in and of itself and make that determination on our own?
Well, I mean, the confession, if you view the confession and you see the investigator, he's asking him, like, where's the body? We need to find the body. And he's taking them to the location. Yes, nobody said that was later found to be true at the hearing, but I mean, the confession is there. It's part of the record. It was admitted into evidence.
Counsel, I mean, obviously we're cognizant of the importance of this case and the seriousness of the nature of this case, and the fact that there was a child that lost his life, and we're very cognizant and very sympathetic, you know, to the family that suffered this great loss. Unfortunately, the rules are what the rules are, and my question is, well, was a question asked to any of the officers that were called to testify? I know the judge was called to testify, but that really would not have been sufficient. Any questions to the effect of what did you find out at the interrogation or when he took you to the scene that was substantial or that you did not know prior to the interrogation or anything that there could be a basis for the second prong to apply or the other section to apply? Or are you just saying look at the confession and it speaks for itself?
No, that was not elicited at the hearing, Judge. The only thing I can say is that Judge Valdez presides over this case and two other co-defendants, one who had a trial the month before. And that my time is up, so I have 5 minutes.
Thank you. You'll have your 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, justices. You all seem to have a command of the statute at issue, and 51.095 is kind of a complicated statute. So I'm going to move in a way that I hadn't planned. And I'd like to start just by pointing out one thing about the subsection F and the argument of the state. The state's argument, at least at the time of the hearing and in their brief, is that subsection F is discretionary. That's the word they use. And because it's discretionary, the fact that it was not successfully completed and that there was no finding as to voluntariness, that it doesn't matter. And the interesting thing is the case that they cite is the Hill case. And in the Hill case, the statute that's being scrutinized is 28.01 of the Code of Criminal Procedure, which is one that every criminal trial lawyer is very familiar with. And the opinion in that case, the court says that the words may, must, and shall can coexist in a statute and do in 2801 without being mutually exclusive. In fact, they use a Latin term that I don't want to use up any time trying to pronounce. But if you think about it, 28.01 says that the court may set a matter for a pretrial hearing. If the court exercises that discretion, then the defendant must be present at the hearing. And the court shall give at least 10 days notice of the scheduling of that hearing. Now, if you employ the logic that is being set out by the state, the court could say, I am going to set this matter for pretrial. I'm going to have that hearing right now. I don't care that the defendant is not present, and likewise, the defense counsel will not get notice, so they're not going to be here either. So let's get started. That's the gist of it. And there's some legislative history in the Texas Bill Analysis document, HB 2884-2007, talking about the introduction of that part of the statute that says the magistrate's determination of voluntariness shall be reduced to writing, in discussing why that was amended in 2007. The legislature said it clarifies that the magistrate's determination of voluntariness of a juvenile statement must be reduced to writing, signed and dated by the magistrate. It's not ambiguous, and to argue that if part of a statute is discretionary, if the use of the statute or the law is discretionary, that then however one chooses to use it, regardless of what other mandatory language there may be in that procedure, is inoperative, then there would have been no reason to enact that part of the statute. 51.095 has been amended, I think, four times since it was enacted in 1997. And each time that has been to improve and enhance the protection of children who are finding themselves in a custodial interrogation situation. And that really ought to be the end of this, because those facts are undisputed, that the child was in custody, that the JP, Judge Barrera, employed subsection F. He read it into the recording. He recited it verbatim from the proceeding, and then nothing happened. He said for 3 hours, and the child was never brought back, and the recording was never brought back. None of that's disputed. And so the argument of the state is that if you just, however you can manage it, don't comply. If there's a failure to give a written finding regarding voluntariness, then no harm, no foul, the statement comes in. And as I think Justice has suggested, if that's the case, then the law enforcement can refuse to return the child in the recording. The justice, the magistrate judge can get tired and go home. One of those two things happened here. It doesn't make any sense. And that argument just does not hold water. And there is no case law to suggest otherwise.
Well, how do you respond to their argument that we have the unique circumstance in this case where there was a determination made by a judge, the first judge in this case, that the statement was given voluntary? So they're arguing that even if they did violate the statute, the effect of having done so was, I guess, sort of
cured
by the findings of the first trial judge.
Well, all right. One way to look at it is this. None of that was before Judge Valdez. None of it. None of it was brought up. None of it was introduced by the state. Any of it could have been. The parties agreed to revisit this. And so in this situation, I believe, because I agree with the state about the standard of review, that this court is obliged to review the record before Judge Valdez to make some determination as to whether or not there was, one, an issue regarding credibility of the testimony. And in this case, I don't think there is. So then it becomes a de novo application of the law to the record before him. And that's uniform throughout the cases. And we agree with that. So the question here is, did he abuse his discretion in applying the law to the facts? The state had the opportunity to present whatever they were going to present. And I would have mentioned later, but I'll say now, for instance, they did not offer any testimony, did not ask the one investigating officer anything about what Sebastian Torres may have said that would have led them to undiscovered evidence.
But clearly, Counselor, the fact that the body, I mean, that he told them where the body was, they up until that point, they'd not discovered the body. Isn't that just speak for itself, that there was clearly evidence that had not been obtained until the child defendant led them to the scene and pointed out where the body was located?
Isn't Justice, that's what the state says in their argument. That's mm-hmm. nowhere in the hearing. That's not presented by testimony. And I would submit to you that it is not clear that that's in the interview.
If that was in the interview and the record, I mean, the transcript or the recording was admitted into evidence, doesn't it just obvious that that is new evidence that the police had not discovered up until that point?
Well, there are two responses to that. One, it's not. I've reviewed the interview, and of course y'all will be invited to review it also. Most of it is in Spanish, which creates a problem because the state never offered a translation, not in either hearing. And it's, if you listen to it, and of course because it's bilingual, it's subject to a kind of interpretation that perhaps just a straight English interrogation might not be. but it's not clear. There are indications in that record, in that interview, that the police took him out to a staged situation. They took him out, and they had already been there. The police had already been there. They led him there. They knew where the bodies were. They discuss it on the video. He didn't lead them anywhere. But I mean, that's me arguing the case, which is, I mean, I understand and I respect, and there is, I respect the question, and there is some case law, and I can't remember if it's Harry.
I'm sorry.
Come on. Let me confiscate that phone.
Or one, I thought I was out of time. Or one of the or one of the other cases that suggests that where the record is before the trial court, mm-hmm. and the appellate court gets an opportunity to review it, and it contradicts the testimony of a witness, that the appellate court would have an opportunity to review it, and that would be proper. So I'm not saying don't look at the interview. I'm just saying that there are several reasons why it's not really applicable here. Because one, it's not undisputed. And for that reason, the trial court's decision then should be given even more latitude and respect than if it were an undisputed fact. At that point, the court could review de novo. And I think that's the proper analysis of this case.
But the position is that provision isn't applicable here because this juvenile was in custody, correct?
Yes.
Is the law clear on that point? Because you cited to this McGilvery that proposition?
McGilvery, that's a jailhouse cellie confession.
Right.
And so it doesn't really speak to this issue. The best case to talk about A2 uh-huh. is In re D.A.R. And in that case, it's an El Paso opinion.
Distinguish that one?
Well, that actually applies, and that's the one that we cited.
Okay.
And it is a published opinion.
D.A.R.?
In re D.A.R. A situation where the issue is whether or not the interrogation was custodial. Mm.
But that was because the warnings were not given while he was in custody.
But it's the only case that we could find, and I suspect the only case out there right now, that talks about A2 and when it does and when it doesn't apply as that relates to whether or not the interrogation is custodial. And the majority opinion finds that it was a custodial interrogation, and therefore the statement should be suppressed because A2 does not apply. Now, that's their ruling. There's a dissent. Judge McClure dissents. Mm-hmm. And her dissent is that the majority has misinterpreted an old case that I used to get a lot of mileage out of, Doubt It, D-O-W-T-H-I-T-T, I think, regarding how you analyze whether or not defendant's in custody. And she says that it's not a custodial statement. But when she does that, her comment is, in dissenting with the majority, is that if a child is found to be in custody, the requirements of 51.095A1 or 51.095A5 apply. A1 if it's a written statement, A5 if it's an oral statement. Clearly 2, 3, and 4 don't. And if you just read the statute on its face, a plain and common sense reading of that bears it out. It's at subsection D. It reads, subsection A1 and A5 apply to the statement of a child made while the child is in the custody of an officer. Doesn't say 2, 3, or 4. And in re D.A.R. stands for that premise, that was meant to be these two and not the other three. So regarding that argument of the state, you know, it's not appropriate, it's not right, for two reasons. One, there's nothing before the trial judge on the record. And if one were to say for some reason that the trial judge was charged with having reviewed the interview, and he may or may not have, it is not uncontested evidence. It's not testimony. It is what it is. And it's in Spanish. And the law is clear that there should have been offered a competent translation, and there just wasn't. The state's argument is that just because they say that's in there, the court ought to say that it applies and let the evidence in. Really, and it may not be intentional, but if you take the three points of error in the state's brief, the first point really is that a child, if you read a child his rights, her rights, that the statement then becomes admissible regardless of whether they understand it. And that's, they cite another unpublished opinion, but that's the gist of it, that you don't have to really get a clear response from the child indicating they understand each of the admonitions that come under Miranda. So you can read somebody, a kid, their rights. If you read it, statement comes in. Point two is that if a magistrate decides to use, subsection F and read into the recording that the interrogators bring the child back with the recording, if for whatever reason that isn't done, it doesn't matter. The statement comes in. The mandatory part of that statute is ignored. So voluntariness is not an issue, not in the first point, according to them, not in the second, and in the third. And that is where they invoke A2, which we think clearly doesn't apply, regardless of what's in that videotape. They're saying that if you have a child in custody, if they say something incriminating, it's going to be admissible regardless of how you got it. And if you want to be extreme, what they're saying in these three points is that you can take a kid into custody, show him your gun, slap him around a little bit, take his statement, and if you read him his rights, it's coming in, regardless of what the magistrate did beforehand, regardless of whether or not he was given an opportunity to see his parents, and that's it. They're saying that a child is afforded less protection against the jeopardy of a coerced incriminating statement, that a child is being afforded less protection afforded by the Fifth Amendment not to incriminate oneself due to coercion. And if you read 51095, and particularly pay attention to the amendments that come, in each instance the effort is to try to enhance and clarify that the child is supposed to get more protection, not less. The cases, for instance, the case I think cited, SDS, that's a 1994 case. There are a number of cases cited by the state that precede the enactment of 51.095. Some of them refer back to the old statute 51.09. But, and I'm not saying that these cases have no meaning, no application in any situation, but if you say that they control, despite what's clearly in the statute, then you're saying the legislature is, what they have done has no meaning, has no application, has no force. It is a, the events that bring us here are tragic. They are garish, gruesome, and that's unfortunate. It will weigh on everyone's mind that has anything to do with this case. But this case needs to be tried in court, and it needs to be done so with the defendants, including my client, being afforded all of the protection that this state has decided that a child ought to be afforded. And in this case, The state did not follow the proceeding. It's not the state. It just wasn't followed. It really doesn't matter who did it or didn't do it. It just wasn't done. And the statute itself says if this wasn't done, then the evidence is not admissible. A2 does not apply. We have case law that says it doesn't. I really appreciate the attention that y'all have had. I thank you very much. I don't have anything else to add unless there's a question.
Nope. Thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you.
May it please the court. So first going off the translation, there was no objection by the appellee at the hearing when the state's exhibits 3 and 4, which was the confession of Mr. Torres, were admitted into evidence, which was the recording. and the whole argument that they led him there to the crime scene, that it was staged, well, he was the last co-defendant that was interviewed, and law enforcement already knew at that point he'd be the only person that would know the location of the body. So now, Pelly argues that it's the state's position to afford a child less rights through what my argument is in my brief, and that is not my argument at all today. Before this, I was not a scholar in juvenile law at all. Our office only handles felonies. So I've been working on this case for years, and I looked at the purpose and interpretation of 5101, Title 3, the Juvenile Justice Code. And if you look at that, it says the purpose is to effectuate the following public purposes, and amongst them are 6. And it's mostly all of them speak to protect the welfare of the community and control the commission and unlawful acts by children. And the last one says to provide a simple judicial procedure through which the provisions of this title are executed and enforced, to which the parties are assured a fair hearing. And that's all the state is asking. I believe the trial court erred when Judge Valdez did not consider that the exception, the found to be true exception, applied. It does not apply only when the child is not in custody. And that is evidenced in the case that I cited, which I told Chief Justice right now, which was SDJ. In DAR, which the appellee goes off of, in that case, that was a Miranda violation. They focused on a Miranda analysis. In that case, the child, they said, no, the child was in custody already. He should have been given his Miranda rights, and you didn't. Therefore, any evidence that was obtained after that is going to be thrown out. Right here, Sebastian Torres did receive his Miranda warnings, not once, but twice. He waived them. He spoke to law enforcement freely and voluntarily. And if you look at the testimony from Detective Marquez or Investigator Marquez, he testified, was he given water? Yes. Was he given food? Yes. Restroom breaks? Yes. And if you look at the testimony from Justice Barrera, when he was asked by appellee's counsel, well, what is it that you look for when you make the determination of voluntariness, like if you were to go back and make a finding? Well, I look at to see if the child was given food, water, restroom break, things like that. When Investigator Marquez was asked those questions, he said, yes, we gave him restroom breaks, food, water. You look at the confession itself, he was given food, water, restroom breaks whenever he asked for them. Now, in DAR, the dissent by Justice Anne McClure, she also says, due process is violated only by confessions that are not in fact freely given rather than mere noncompliance with prophylactic rules, absent coercive police conduct, casually related to the confession. There's simply no basis to conclude that any state actor has deprived a criminal defendant of due process of law. There was no due process of law violation here. And if there was, and if you believe that subsection F was mandatory and he should have been taken back and the JP should have made that determination and should have written it down, then I ask that you reverse the trial court's decision based on the fact that the trial court found that no exception applied and that the found to be true exception didn't apply in this case because that one subsection F was invoked, that that was dominant, and no other exception applied. If you look at Henry Mack, you will see that each subsection stands on its own. Whether in custody or not, each subsection stands on its own. And the found to be true exception has been applied while a child has been in custody and when a child has not been in custody. And I think my time is out. I thank you for your time today. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good argument on both sides. The case will be under submission.